All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're in the Delaware Valley. Welcome to the Saul Silvano Show here on WWDB. We have a fantastic show. Lots going on in the city of Philadelphia. Happy to bring in the host of our broadcast, John Zervanos. John, how are you, sir?
Fantastic.
It's great to be back, of course, in your scenic offices. Love this place. And, you know, we're going to be talking some law today, but we're going to be talking some medical malpractice, but not necessarily on the plaintiff side. We're going to be looking at the defense side, and we have a fantastic guest I want to bring into the program, Rafael Villalobos. And Rafael is a deputy general counsel for Capitol Health. How are you, sir?
Doing very well. Thanks for having me.
More importantly, how am I doing? Did I get that right?
You nailed it. That's one of the only ones.
Well, I've been practicing all night, so we're good. John told me, don't mess that up. So
you know what that means? It means House of the Wolves.
Does it? Lobos, you know? I like it. Yeah. I like it. Very cool. Sounds like a band or something like that. Or, you know, Los Lobos. Yeah, yeah, right. But anyway, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you.
And if you would, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, sure. You know, your background, and then also obviously about Capitol Health.
Surely, happy to do that. So, in terms of my background, I've been practicing law for almost 30 years now. I started my career right here in the Philadelphia area, representing hospitals and representing doctors in medical malpractice cases, catastrophic loss cases. I did that for about 13 years. And one of my clients was the old Frankfurt Hospital System in Northeast Philadelphia.
Yeah, I remember. Well, lived up the street from Frankfurt Hospital, right at Folkrod and Frankfurt there.
Yeah, yep. They have three different hospitals up there, two in Philly, one in Bucks. And I was at their Torsdale campus, so Knights and Red Lion. And they asked me to come on board and become their chief legal counsel and senior vice president. And I worked there for about 11 years, and I was responsible for various departments, insurance, claims, compliance, any number of different administrative departments. And then ARIA in 2016, Frankfurt became ARIA, and then ARIA was acquired by Jefferson.
Right.
And when it was acquired by Jefferson in 2016, I went back into private practice and continued to represent hospitals, and I represented doctors and various other providers. I went back to school, got an MBA with a concentration in healthcare, and then lightning struck a second time. The chief counsel for Capitol called me up and asked me if I'd be willing to come back into healthcare, and told me about this new position that he was creating. And it sounded great, and my wife and I talked it over, and been there for 2 years now, very happy. And
I already know you're a smart man.
Yeah.
Got the wife's approval, right?
Yeah, that's critical, critically important.
Exactly.
Capitol
Health.
Sure. So Capitol Health, you know, I've worked in and I've represented various health systems. And, you know, one nice thing I can tell you is that they have a mission. They are tied to the community, and they do try to provide great services to the people who live in the community. Capitol is really a critical component, I think, to the Trenton area. They have two major hospitals, one in Hopewell, one in Trenton. And, you know, it is a significant employer. We have over 5,000 employees, so it contributes to the community. And then we are a significant provider of a full range of services medically, and we give back to the community in various ways. So it's a terrific organization, very, very happy with it. And, you know, they really do make a difference in the lives of the people in the community.
And having said that, so this is an odd, you know, it's almost like, I mean, typically, John, you're a plaintiff attorney when it comes to Mid-Mal, and you're a defense.
Yeah.
So it's like bringing Ollie and Frazier on.
We're going to wrestle.
Well, one thing that you're going to find out is unless you get along with the other side, you're not going to get anything done.
Yeah.
So we generally get along with the other side.
Hey, you know what's funny about that? And as attorneys and successful attorneys, I wonder on that note, you guys are really successful and, you know, I've litigated, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens and hundreds of times. I'm sure you both have been in court and saw somebody on the other side who wasn't, you know, like who didn't take that approach.
Oh,
who,
yeah.
Even with the judge or the jury. Yep. And when you look at, when you do something like that, I'm going to take a shot at this, but you're probably sitting there going, I guess, thank you very much.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, but you also learn that I'm not going to, that I know one thing, I'm not going to do that.
No.
You know what, Joe, likability is such an enormous factor in this business.
Yeah.
It's not just how likable is the lawyer, but how likable are the clients. You have most doctors are very respected individuals and they're good people, and suing a doctor is challenging, not just because the community reveres them most of the time,
right?
But naturally they're nice people, and you have to respect that dynamic as a lawyer, or you're going to get yourself in a lot of hot water.
You know, it's interesting. I was in the hospital a couple years ago, and I remember being, I had an infection in my knee, and it got serious, and I wasn't paying attention to it. I thought it was the gout. So I thought they said with gout, 15 days and you'll be okay. Right. Well, 15 days and I wasn't okay. And so I go to the hospital, I got a fever, they put me in the hospital and they transfer me to another one. And I remember being in there and of course they saved my life. No question. They saved my leg and likely my life. I didn't have sepsis, but it was an infection that developed in my knee, got the surgery and got it. But I remember being in there and I remember that I didn't know much about hospitals, but being asked for my information by several different people.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought to myself, these are different vendors. You know, the left hand has to know what the right hand is. But I guess what I'm saying is, and I say this to both of you, there's a lot of moving parts.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And you never really realize that. I just gave my name. This is a new person coming in. And so, you know, it's not surprising that, you know, if we're all human beings and things happen, doesn't mean somebody is unqualified, or it doesn't mean also that it's a medical malpractice case. I have, heard, and, you know, it's very hard to prove medical malpractice cases, and I'm sure even in your personal lives and in your life every day, John, but everybody self-diagnoses themselves, you know, when it comes to a cold or something like that, but also in a lawsuit. My buddy was in the hospital not long ago, and he said to me, he was fine, but he was spent a specific amount of time, and he goes, I'm suing the doctor. I want my guess. Let's be real about this. I'm an iron worker, Joe, but I do legal radio. I don't have to go to a lawyer to tell you, you don't have a case. You know, he was mad at the doctor. I'm like, but there are dozens of hundreds of situations like that where people think they have
sure,
and it's more complicated.
Everybody thinks they have a case when they get a bad result. I'm going to call a lawyer, and we field so many phone calls. It's you talk about we're the gatekeepers.
Yeah. I mean,
you have no idea how many calls we take, maybe not a day, but sometimes a day. And during the course of the week, probably a dozen calls at least. Of people telling us, oh, we have a case. Wait until you hear this one.
Right. hey, let me say this. I'll give you two instances. And one of these instances was an iron worker. I do a labor injured workers program. And this guy had a workers compensation case. Here he was represented. He was getting paid. He got injured on the job. However, he went to one of the big hospitals, and as he was going up for surgery, it was the biggest doctor in the hospital that was doing it, right? But he swore he saw a guy leave the elevator and walk out the door. And so he swore somebody else did it. It was an elbow thing. He swore something was left in his arm. He couldn't get any lawyer to take the case. Finally, a lawyer came to me and he said this. And a good guy. He's a med mal guy. And he said, Joe, there may be a case there. There may not be a case there, but it's not a big case, and it's not. No one's going to take the case, and it's not the doctor. He thought the doctor was intimidating everybody, right? It wasn't. The guy gave me a great explanation. When I called that guy and told him, and he trusted me because you know, I'm a union guy. The guys really changed his whole perspective. Like, you know, like it changed his life. Yeah. You know, he felt good. He said, I get it. It was logical. But he was just getting turned down. And he could, and I'm telling you, I never seen anybody swear they had a Med Mal case more than this guy.
Well, that's an issue. I think people don't understand health care. People don't understand how medicine is practiced. They don't understand how hospitals operate. And there are so many misconceptions, and one of the things that, you know, John and I talked about in terms of me coming on the program was to try to demystify things a bit so that the public, your listeners out there, maybe they do get that perspective that you're talking about. You know, all of a sudden, oh, now I get it. Because, you know, I really do believe that people go into medicine for the right reasons. They're trying to do the right thing for the right reasons. You know, they're trying to get good outcomes, but, you know, obviously there can be untoward events, right? There can be bad things that happen too. Sometimes it might be an error, sometimes it's not. And, you know, understanding that is critically important. You know, and I think John, when he's vetting, when he's fielding all these calls on a weekly basis, you know, he's looking at liability. In other words, was there a breach in the standard of care? Is there causation? What are the damages? Are the damages significant enough for this law firm to invest the time and the money and the energy into it over the next couple of years before potentially we might get some type of a recovery?
Not only that, is there going to be any recovery left for the plaintiff? That was the issue with this. The guy said if there is, there may or may not be, but the case itself, you know, you have a situation where there's not going to be anything left, and that's why they're not taking it. You know,
John, we touched on that before. The expense associated with malpractice lawsuits is enormous, and I go to great lengths to explain to the client on day one how much money this case is going to cost. And like everybody else, you know, they say it's not going to cost you anything, but if you do make a recovery,
the expenses, you know, come off.
The expenses top. Come out of the recovery, and they have to understand, so there's no surprises, how much money these cases cost. And it's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars sometimes.
Now, John, you have to be somewhat, I mean, you have to calculate that you can never, and I know this, obviously, we've talked many times, obviously, you don't know the value of a case at the beginning, but you do have to make an educated guess on what it's going to cost to investigate it, to be able to take the case, and at the same time hire investigators and all that. And then, like was in that case that I just mentioned, and take a look and say, is there going to be enough, you know, to make a recovery for this person to spend? And these things, they can last a while.
Sure.
I mean, you know,
especially now that everything's backed up.
Yeah, right. No question about it. The other case, by the way, was a guy who lost his leg and couldn't get an attorney. And the doctor actually told. So my point is, as a layperson, we clearly need to rely on the experts and to have these things go. How long can a Med-Mal case go?
Years. I mean, 3-4 years, depending on the venue. I mean, some counties are working very efficiently, others are not. You know, and if you're a defendant, how much incentive do you have to resolve a case if you know you're not going to be called into court for years? I mean, there's no whole lot of incentive. Obviously, if you've got a trial date staring at you, there's going to be more motivation by each side to get something done, but that's
right
way
and,
out there.
And which amazes me, because HIPAA is, you know, like I go into the dentist and I got 45 papers that, and I sit there and we've had these conversations in shows, and I'll sit there and go, well, I worried about it. But you know, obviously you're taking every precaution possible,
sure.
But it's, you know, I think about the possible. I've heard, is this true that in the city of Philadelphia, 250 to 300 cases go to court for malpractice, maybe 1,000 settle. But my point is it true that it's a minute amount that actually go to court?
Oh, I don't know if that, I don't know about that exact number, those numbers that you're telling me about, but there's a small fraction of lawsuits that wind up inside of a courtroom. But in terms of the categories of cases, the cases that are tried more than any type of case civilly are usually medical malpractice cases.
Okay. I mean, it's a hugely interesting area. Having said that, let me ask Raphael, is it true that malpractice lawsuits increase the cost of medicine?
So it's a great question. There's a lot of debate.
Well, I put a lot of time into that question, didn't I, John?
I'll tell you what, PwC did a study. The Congressional Budget Office had done a study on it in terms of trying to quantify the impact. But let me explain a few things about healthcare for your listeners and maybe along the lines of the demystification we talked about. So you're all familiar, all of us as kids had a lemonade stand, or our kids have had lemonade stands, right? And how much does it cost really to make that cup of lemonade, right? Maybe 5 cents.
Right.
It's the water, it's the lemon, it's the sugar, it's the cup. You sell it for a dollar.
Right.
You get 95% margin.
Right.
Right. So healthcare is pretty much the inverse of that. In other words, it costs 95 cents in overhead, in expenses, you know, to run this big facility that's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, fully staffed, security, housekeeping, maintenance, doctors, nurses, therapists, the whole nine yards, all the other costs in associated with the building, the insurance. So when you factor all that in, you're looking at 95 cents to try to sell something for a dollar, right? So now you have a 5% margin, which most people don't realize. Most hospitals, if they have a 4, 5, 6% margin, they're doing pretty well. So why is that? The reason is you've got all the expense, but then on the flip side, you have the revenue. The revenue is the reimbursement that comes from different payers. You have a governmental payer, which is CMS, Medicare, Medicaid, and that's roughly 50% of your mix. But then in addition to that, you have the private payers, you have the Aetnas and the IBCs, right? So there are so many rules now from the private payers, from the governmental payers, in terms of reimbursement, that impact whether or not you even get that 5 cents, right? What they say is, well, yeah, you took care of the patient, but the patient was readmitted within 30 days, so now you're not going to get paid. Or you were going to get paid, but we decided your documentation was not appropriate. Well, you were going to get paid, but here's a problem. There was a medical complication, an infection, whatever the case might be. So now you're not necessarily getting that 5%. So small margins is what we operate in. So to answer your question, do I think that medical malpractice impacts the cost of healthcare? Yes, and I'll explain why. Hard to quantify. I can't sit here today and say, oh, it's, you know, X number of dollars or X percent. I think reimbursement is candidly the larger of the two issues. But when you think about it on the defense side, right? So I've worked in hospitals and healthcare for a long time. A lot of hospitals have decided over the years it costs too much money to buy insurance on the private market, right? So what do? They form a captive insurance company.
What type of insurance?
This is hospital professional liability.
Okay.
Right? So medical malpractice insurance, yeah, essentially for a hospital and for the people who work in the hospital. So, you know, you form a captive, you form your own private insurance company, and you have to fund it, right? You have to pay premiums into it. It's not funny money. It's a real company. And, you know, sometimes they're based in the Cayman Islands, or they're based in Vermont, or where have you. In any event, you have to pay the lawyers and the accountants and the actuaries to comply with all of the regulatory requirements. So those are what you call frictional costs. So there are a lot of frictional costs associated with these insurance companies. But then in addition to that, in order to maintain lower premiums on reinsurance, which I'll tell you about in a second, hospitals, they retain a certain amount of risk. In other words, like when you go out and get car insurance, right, you can have a small deductible, but it's going to cost you more in premiums, right? Or if you have a big deductible, maybe you get a break on your premiums. So hospitals essentially say, you know what, we're gonna take the hit up front. We're going to pay a lot in terms of the deductible, it'll come out of our captive, and that way we can control the costs of the reinsurance. Reinsurance is essentially layers of insurance above what you already have, right? So as it relates to this structure of insurance, you're also paying for the attorneys that represent the hospitals and the medical malpractice cases, and you're paying the court costs and the experts and the deposition transcripts and everything else. And that can be hundreds of thousands of dollars per case. And a hospital might have dozens of cases pending at any given point.
I was going to say how I mean, just I don't know if you can put an average on it, but you're in a risk business, about it.
Sure.
It's any given time, you know.
You could have between auto cases, slip and fall cases, medical malpractice cases, a regional hospital, you could have anywhere between 50 and 75 cases pending at any given time. Then you throw in employment cases, you know, people claim harassment or discrimination. If you're a larger academic quaternary medical center, a big university system, multiples of that are possible, right? So are there expenses associated with litigation? Yes, from the captive side, from the insurance side, from the defense side, but then also the premiums you pay for these layers of reinsurance to make sure that, you know, John's law firm comes along, they decide to sue you, they have a big case. You need those protections on top of your captive so that if there's a settlement or if there's a jury award, you're in a better position to be able to protect the institution and the institution's assets.
And John, on your on the plaintiff's side, you have to get a case qualified, right? So there's not a ton of frivolous lawsuits on top of.
Well, there shouldn't be any. There shouldn't be any frivolous lawsuits.
Well, you know what I mean. Like, how about this one? Unqualified attorneys representing clients that don't really have cases, and costing the system money. When, you know, obviously, you know, so now there's a system that makes sure, obviously.
The system in place requires that, whether you're in New Jersey or Pennsylvania, requires you to have a doctor review the case, whatever the issue is. And if it's a complicated case involving various specialties, you need a doctor qualified in each individual specialty to provide you in New Jersey, it's called an affidavit of merit, and you have to have that when you serve the within 60 days of filing that complaint in New Jersey. And that just establishes that, you know, you have doctors that have looked at it, reviewed it, and support the allegations that you're making. And you have the same situation in Pennsylvania. It's called something else, but the same requirements are essentially applied, and for the same reasons, to make sure that these cases are meritorious. And that doesn't mean you're going to win. That just means that your experts say this, and the defendants will come in and typically will have a different position. Raphael, in the beginning, you know, there's like a three-prong test. You know, has the doctor or hospital breached the standard of care? That's the negligence aspect, okay? And a lot of people think that the analysis ends right there. Oh, I was a victim of malpractice, so I should get compensated. But then the next prong is, was there causation? You know, did that error cause what you're alleging? Okay? The problem is that a lot of times when people call you, they have a lot of things going on in their lives medically. So if you're a doctor, you can take the position and incredibly take the position that the damages that you're alleging are not a result of what happened to you. They're a natural consequence of
diabetes,
your underlying condition. All right. And that's called causation. And I can't tell you how many times I've gone to court, and when the jury's reading off the answers to the questions, did you find Dr. So-and-so? Did he meet the standard of care? And they say no. And you're like, okay, here I go. And you get to the next question. was Dr. So-and-so's negligence a factual cause of Mr. So-and-so's, you know, injury, whatever the alleged, and you get the no, and you stop right there.
And now, they don't get the damages.
Yeah.
They stop there at causation.
Yeah.
That game over.
And causation, I got to tell you, causation is where the rubber meets the road.
Yep.
Because that, it's almost, it's just almost available to every medical defendant out there. Because 9 times out of 10, there's
what's the definition of causation?
It did it cause it? Did you know? Did
but for this,
yeah.
Did the reason you're suing them cause the issue?
Yeah. Now, if let's say you have take a cancer case, all right, and you have somebody who missed a diagnosis, and you know the argument is early diagnosis is always going to result in a better,
right,
better prognosis.
And they missed the tumor, or
and they missed it, and it allowed it to go on for so much time, and now you've got a bigger problem. I can't tell you. When I first got into this business, I was like, oh, look at that. The cancer was there for how long? We can make an argument that it spread, and you know, oh, they're going to pay this case. Well, no. You go and file the lawsuit. You say it was misdiagnosed. You missed it. Now my client has got all this compromised prognosis. And sure enough, the defense comes in and argues, well, this cancer grows like this. And because he or she had this particular comorbidity, that doesn't necessarily mean that had you gotten it sooner, it would have made a difference. And before you know it, the idea that the defense is just to confuse.
Well, it obviously what you're experiencing. I get a kick out of when I see a plaintiff law firm, not an experienced, reputable firm like this, but somebody you know, and they have a website, right? I just did a show a couple of weeks ago with somebody, and as I sat down, they told me all the things they couldn't really talk about, right? Med-Mal, of course, is always one of them, right? They don't really do Med-Mal. They refer it out, okay, as you guys know. But you have to know at least a portion of the medicine.
No question. I was telling Raphael this before we went on air today. I've been doing this for 35 years. The last half of my career, 50% of my personal practice is dedicated to representing victims of medical malpractice. So over the course of time, I've learned a lot of medicine, and couple that with personal experiences and family and yourself.
Sure, and studying and working
over the course of time, you know, I'm a physician's son. So over the course of time, I've learned a lot of medicine. I got friends that'll call me and say, "Can you read these lab results?" And
you know, I can throw a disclaimer on it and say,
but I can go through it and tell them what this means. Oh, you got to check this out. This is why you have to know about this. And whether or not it's a good or a bad thing, I've learned a lot.
Sure.
All right. And that helps me representing victims. What's interesting, though, is, you know, a lot of medical malpractice defense lawyers, all they do is medical malpractice defense. So you get really, really good at it. I don't just do medical malpractice. So, you know, I have a products case that I was telling Raphael about where now I got to turn around and put my engineer's cap on. And, you know, there's a reason why I didn't go into math-oriented topics, because it's so complicated, my head's going to explode. And we jump from topic to topic to topic, and we have to try to become masters of everything.
But you also get experts to work with you in every area.
Sure, but they have to teach you.
Right.
And you have to be smart enough to recognize that you don't know anything about the topic that you're getting into.
And by the way, but having said that, and I say this, when you are injured, if you do have a lawsuit, being able to go to a firm that has the resources to call in qualified experts.
No question.
Because if you don't, you're in huge trouble. And as a regular person out there, you don't know the difference.
Being able to finance these cases.
Finance them.
I sometimes joke, you know, we had Susan Wilde on the show
a
couple months, maybe a month ago,
yeah,
who's a congressman. And her big complaint was, every 2 years, I feel like I'm running for office constantly.
Right.
And it's so expensive, and I got to constantly, raise money.
Yeah.
Well, I'm running around. I got to constantly raise money. You know, we have our ways. I mean, we have funding and sources and so forth. But you go from one case to another case to another case, and you got to figure out where you're getting all the money.
How many medical plaintiff real medical malpractice attorneys are there in the city of Philadelphia? I say that there can't be a lot.
Real.
Handful at best.
No, this is a big city. I can tell you there's quite a few that really know what they're doing. Obviously you have your super top shelf law firms and so forth. And obviously reputation makes a significant difference. But I can tell you this, when you go out to a place like Lancaster or Harrisburg or Allentown, there you only have, there's like one pro.
Right.
There's one office in town that does the malpractice.
And I'll go to Raphael. First of all, do you educate? Is there a continuing education for doctors
Absolutely.
On issues like this?
Sure.
And are you a part of it?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So we do education year round. We do it for nurses. We do it for our attending staff. We do it for the medical residents. So the people who have finished medical school, but they're not able to practice independently yet. So those residents, first, second, third year residents, we do education all the time for them. And, the education comes from various sources, right? It comes from other clinicians, specialists, nurses sometimes provide education to physicians because there are policy issues, medical record issues, communications issues. I do a lot of training and education on how to avoid John, right? I do education on how to not get sued. I do education on compassion and empathy. I do education on documentation. I'll tell you a real quick story. And I tell this story to the residents. Years and years ago, probably 20 plus years ago, I was representing a large academic medical center. And I was representing an organ transplantation surgeon. And the case involved a young guy. He was only in his 30s. And this young guy had a lot of complications, had a long stay at the hospital. So he and his wife decided they were going to sue the doctor and they were going to sue the hospital.
This is after an organ transplant?
This is multi-organ transplant.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I was taking the wife's deposition. And the wife, who was an attorney, by the way, she's sitting across the table in the conference room and her attorney's sitting next to her. And I asked a pretty standard question, which is, do you maintain a diary? Do you have a log related to your experiences and your husband's experiences? And she says to me, yes, as a matter of fact, I do. And really, by rights, her lawyer should have given that to me already because we had requested it. But suffice to say, we took a break. He gets me a spiral notebook. And I start going through this notebook, and I'm about halfway through the notebook, and I get to a page, and the page has a line running down the middle, so two columns, and the columns, and what I'm about to tell you was an epiphany, right? It was one of those moments
Yeah.
where you have clarity, right? The two columns were labeled people to sue, people not to sue, right? So then I started reading all the entries under each of the columns. And I'll cut to the chase.
I know where you're going.
So do I.
It's all about
treating people nicely.
Interpersonal relationships, taking a personal interest in people. The people who they didn't want to sue, Dr. So-and-so was so nice. He came every day and he sat down next to my husband and he put his hand on his shoulder and he talked to him. On the other column, the guy, the doctor who stood at the door, didn't even bother coming in the room and looked at the TV hanging off the wall.
Yeah.
That's the one they want to sue,
yeah.
Right? So a lot of my education and training is about, listen, you go to work every day wearing scrubs. You go to work every day wearing Crocs or whatever your shoes are, or a lab coat. It's a day at the office. For these people here, your patients and their family members, it's not a day at the office, right? They're scared. They've got a loved one who's sick, who's dying, who was just in a car accident, trauma. These are people who are scared. They're raw emotionally. And if I'm fortunate to live another 30, 40 years, I probably will work for another 20 of those years. One of the things that I'm trying to impart in terms of education is having healthcare providers humanize their patients, humanize the family, treat them the way they would want their own family treated. And, you know, those relationships are beneficial for everyone.
Do you think that makes an impact on the, when you're talking huge. To residents, are they paying attention?
So it's interesting. I think to your conversation about engineering a moment ago, I think so many of the people who enter medicine are really skilled when it comes to math and science.
Yeah.
And, you know, the EQ, the emotional component, the interpersonal skill,
yeah,
they don't necessarily possess that. So mm-hmm. I try to instill it because some of them don't naturally have it.
You know what's funny about that? I do some medical radio too, and this one doctor, he's a great guy, but it's a long hour because, you know, he doesn't say much, and he's my client, and I'm you know, trying to bring it out of him. And so I've often wondered that particular thing. I want to, at the same, John, can we blow through the break? And yeah, because we got 25 minutes left.
Yeah, I want to touch on something that I think is important for the listeners, and we talked about this off air. I find it, in the last 20 years, I've noted this consolidation of health systems.
Yeah.
And I'm intrigued by, you know, I had my own ideas of why that was happening as a lawyer. And Raphael explained to me what the advantages are of you got the Penn Health System, you got Jefferson, you know, all of a sudden it's all these big hospital systems. And he had a great explanation for me. And I'm sure our listeners are interested in understanding why you see all this consolidation going on.
Sure, sure. And there was really the consolidation, the merger, they called it merger mania. And it was real big in 2016, 17, 18. It still exists, but it's not at the fever pitch necessarily that it had been. You know, and that's in part because of FTC oversight and state attorney general oversight. But driving factors, let's go back to the lemonade stand for a second. If hospitals are operating at small margins, right? It's not necessarily sustainable. It's not sustainable long term. So, you know, you need to start thinking about, okay, we need to increase our revenue, we need to reduce our expense, right? That's math, right? Those are real dollars. So if you have, you know, the Joe Hospital and the John Hospital, and you guys are operating 15, 20 miles apart from one another, and you're locked in competition, which according to the federal government is a very good thing in the yeah. sense that, you know, it creates competition.
Yeah, no, not a monopoly, right?
Right, anti-monopolistic practice. So there's benefit to that. Part of the problem, though, is John's got an HR department, a finance department, a legal department. He's got all of these cost centers, an expense structure, a cost structure. You've got the same. Does it make sense, perhaps, for two hospitals that are kind of eking out an existence with a small margin to combine to become more efficient, to reduce some of that expense cost structure? And then also, and I think that this is important, there's the concept of economies of scale, right? The bigger you are, you have more ability to do things. And a good example of that would be a GPO, a group purchasing organization. So if a hospital wants to buy toilet paper, we use toilet paper as an example, and it's going to cost them $50 a case to buy the toilet paper. Well, if that hospital bands together in a group purchasing organization with 10 other hospitals, all of a sudden the per roll price or the per case price drops. So the bigger you are, the more favorable pricing you get. That's a part of it. Another part of it is you have to understand that these hospitals are trying to attract and retain the best possible providers, right? They need to be competitive in the marketplace. But how do you pay these providers with these small margins, right? How do you do it? Well, you know, there's only a couple of things you can.
You say providers, you're talking about doctors.
Doctors and other licensed practitioners, NPs, PAs, people of that nature. You know, how do you do it? The only way to do it is, again, and I should back up just one step. 80% of the hospitals in this country are not-for-profit, right? So what does not-for-profit mean? Everybody's trying to generate a profit, right? In a for-profit organization, the profits go back to the
shareholders.
Exactly.
Right.
In a not-for-profit, the profit goes back into the institution, right? It goes back into, we need a new tower. We need a new MRI machine. We need a new CT scanner. We need a new CT surgeon that we're trying to recruit out of the Cleveland Clinic, right? So you need to have those dollars. You need to have those margins, and you need to get creative. And another factor is there's the hub and spoke. They call it a hub and spoke model, where you have a large quaternary academic medical center that sits in the middle of the city. And as they acquire some of these smaller hospitals in the outlying regions, you know, those hospitals might not necessarily be equipped to do a big open heart procedure or a really complex surgery or oncology case. So those smaller hospitals are then able to tap into the resources of the mothership, the hub, and, you know, they're sending patients into the city to get the more complex, higher acuity level care that's really not available out there. So it's sort of this quid pro quo that the hub, the big hospital, is able to benefit the smaller regional community hospitals and vice versa.
Does it also save money in a sense, because you don't have, you know, if you want to expand and grow, instead of building a whole new wing or you can partner or combine forces with an already established facility that, you know, has the resources you're looking for.
And to that point, another big factor is telehealth, right? So if I don't need bricks and mortar anymore, right? If I don't need to have the big fancy hospital and 24/7 staffing, and if I'm able to provide care to people who are sitting in their own living room or their own dining room, and I'm looking at them and talking to them on their computer screen, these people didn't have the hassle of coming into the city. They didn't have the hassle of dealing with parking. Right?
Well, and the pandemic brought that to light. I mean,
right.
Right now, first of all, this is going in a little different direction. Are you cool with that, John?
Sure.
I mean, we're going into a healthcare, and we got about 14 minutes left. But my point is, it's very interesting because right now, the hardest thing on the planet is to get an appointment with your primary care doctor. I love my guy, but he'll tell you right there, you can't come and see me for 3.5 months. You got to go to the medical, what do you call it? The assistant.
Urgent care.
Well, no, his assistant. They're not a doctor.
The PAs.
The PA, yeah. Exactly. My point is, I can't get an appointment with my, so now you got urgent cares. Now you got medical.
Yeah.
You got that telemed, and you got
clinics and pharmacies.
Yeah, you got all those things happening. And how about the surgical centers? I mean, the system is completely different.
So here's a big piece of that, right? Hospitals, really, the direction they're going into is to take care of the really, really sick and to take care of the really, really seriously injured. And really what you want to see is these lower acuity cases being taken care of in these other settings, because it decompresses the hospitals in terms of the cost structure, and then they can focus on these really seriously injured, seriously sick people. Because a lot of people use an emergency department as their primary care office, and that's not necessarily the most cost-effective means of providing care, right? And it takes resources away from people who really need the care.
And it's interesting, and we'll kind of delve back into the med now, but there's so many different, the system is completely different. You can't than it was when we were kids growing up. Insurance, mm-hmm. For example, what makes I said med mal, but it's not a med mal question. What makes some doctors take, some insurances and others, not take them?
Well, that's a tough
question. Medicare and Medicaid. Some will not take insurance and will take that. And
that's a loaded question.
That's a very loaded question. I will tell you this. There's something called a payer mix, right? So everybody has some percentage of patients that are private payers, meaning Aetna, IBC, insurance companies. And a certain percentage of your patients are governmental payer, CMS, Medicare, Medicaid, right? So in some areas, more affluent areas, you're going to see a payer mix that's heavier on the insurance side, where you have a higher reimbursement rate. And then in some of your more socioeconomically depressed areas, you're going to see a payer mix that's more heavily weighed towards Medicare, Medicaid with lower reimbursement rates. I think some providers have to make a decision about whether or not it's worth it for them. Is there enough of a margin to take the lower reimbursement? Some professions, some specialties like dermatology or, you know, cosmetic surgery.
Yeah, they're not going to take
it. That's cash. You know, that's cash.
Yeah.
But a hospital, in order to be in business, knowing that 50% of the patients coming to you are being insured through the federal government, you don't have a choice. You absolutely are going to take those patients.
So, John, you're one of the questions we have right here, and I'll segue back to where we were, is based on, obviously, medical malpractice. Asking Raphael, have you noticed any increase in malpractice lawsuits or reductions in filings? And what are the trends, and do you have an idea?
Yeah, it's a great question. And what we talked about a little while ago, you know, what John was saying earlier about, you know, the cost of prosecuting a medical malpractice case is so great. And I think that a lot of plaintiff's firms, with some of the tort reform changes, such as affidavits of merit or certificates of merit, you know, they're looking at these cases now and they're saying, well, geez, you know, I got to go through this step and I need to assess liability. In other words, how strong is the liability? And if the liability is really, really strong, I'm more inclined to take the case. But then in addition to that, the damages have to be really, really great. If the damages are not great, then is it really worth the return on the investment, right?
It makes sense. You look at the statistics and you show that 80% or 90% of all malpractice suits filed are won by the doctors in the hospitals.
Yeah.
And in very conservative jurisdictions, they're even, you know, more extreme. And we touched on it earlier, but why are medical practice malpractice lawsuits so difficult for the patient to win? I'll ask both of you that. You know, if you want to jump on, John,
I'll tell you this. I don't think there's a case that's more susceptible to when you sit on a jury. I think every juror has this idea of, I'm here, and what am I doing here, and how might this verdict impact my life? Okay, and I think the medical community years ago did a very good job at effectively, I say this in a way that's appropriate and sensitive to the folks that are listening to us, effectively make enough people in the community concerned about the impact of a malpractice verdict and how it might impact on their own health care.
Sure.
And this is especially significant in a small community where you might have one community hospital and people tend to be conservative to begin with, and you have a lawyer coming in and accusing the local hospital or local physician of making an error. And if you're someone sitting on that jury, you might think to yourself, how does this impact on me?
Well, if it's a local community, that guy might have delivered your child or something.
Sure. And at the end of the day, everybody's looking out for each other.
Right.
And, you know, there was this wave of you know, there was this idea that If you're a plaintiff's lawyer, you have to. There was something called the reptilian theory, which you have to try to impress upon a jury that this verdict is going to affect you, and you have to put it in their lap almost as if you don't find a breach in the standard of care here, and if you don't look at this, it's going to negatively impact on you, and that the care won't become corrected, or they're not going to do anything about this, and it might, you might be the next person.
Right.
Versus if I render a verdict here in favor of this plaintiff, that might negatively impact me because the doctors are leaving and I won't, or my hospital is shut down.
Right.
And
so that, you think juries are looking at other factors aside from the facts that are right.
If you're suing General Motors, all right,
no one really
or some major product manufacturer, they know they're still going to produce the product.
Right.
You know,
they look at them like a different type of corporate entity.
Sure, but that Dr. Smith down the street,
right?
I can't find against him.
Right.
You know, makes who am sense. I going to take my kid to?
And your thought in regards to, you know, and I have an idea of what your answer would be, but
why is it hard for plaintiffs to get verdicts? So I look at it differently, and I respect John's perspective. I don't disagree with his perspective. I would add to it that people like me, right, lawyers who work in healthcare, either in a firm, in a health care setting, risk management, insurance, claims people, you analyze the same issues. You analyze liability. You analyze causation. You analyze damages. You analyze the appeal of the witnesses. And you make a decision. Is this a case that should settle? Is this a case that should go to trial? Because right. It's not a risk. And, you know, I would say the big cases, the cases that these guys bring, right, the cases that they're willing to invest the time and the money and the energy into, you know, those are cases that typically are going to settle. They're not going to end up in a court of law. So the ones that end up in a court of law that end up being defense verdicts are cases that probably have something wrong from a liability perspective or a damages perspective, or the plaintiff attorney wanted too much money.
And Raphael, you're what area, what geographical area do you practice in?
So currently, this system is in New Jersey, in Trenton, New Jersey.
So that's where most of the statistics come from, but where nobody's getting no plaintiffs are getting any verdict. You're like the Johnny Cochran of malpractice. I'm joking.
Well, Jersey's an interesting state because.
By the way, we got 4 minutes.
All right, I want to switch.
Go
because ahead. I you know, Raphael brought this to my attention. You know, the Tulsa thing last week.
Yeah.
A doctor was killed. And I asked him, I said, are you involved in hospital security? He says, as a matter of fact, I am. Yep. And I just wanted to touch on that, and he can offer us what they're doing there.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it. And I got to tell you that Capital Health, and I know other hospitals around the country, this is absolutely positively top of mind. You want to keep your staff safe. You want to keep your employees safe. It's a dangerous world. There are a lot of angry people out there. And, you know, there are a lot of factors that contribute to that. But, you know, at the end of the day, where you see on the news over and over again, people coming in to a hospital, and it could be another employee, it could be a patient, a visitor committing acts of violence. It's a significant problem in healthcare. It's a significant problem that we deal with, you know, with doctors and nurses being punched or kicked or spit at or threatened. Yeah. So we're doing a number of things, right? We're changing policies, we're prosecuting people who commit criminal acts, violent acts, property damage. We're investing in new technologies with panic buttons, metal detector systems. We've redoubled in terms of our security presence.
Security, right.
Working with off-duty sheriff's officers. We've got what are known as amnesty boxes. So if somebody shows up and they see no weapons signs and then they see a metal detector and they say, oh, I've got a knife in my pocket, then what they need to do is they need to deposit this knife in this amnesty box. It's a one-way trip. They never get it back. Or they can take it back out to their car or bring it home, but you're not coming into the hospital, right? So those are some of the things we're doing. We're also doing a lot of education, a lot of training about de-escalation, training about active shooter, training about handle with care, where, you know, our goal, our objective is not to rough people up who are acting out. It's to de-escalate them, get them the care that they need, but not allow other people to be hurt in the process, right? So it's multifactorial. It's evolving. There are a couple of executives at the hospital who I work with very closely who are absolutely 100% dedicated to this, and we've formed action committees and focus groups, and it is top of mind, and you're going to see great changes and big changes in the coming weeks and months.
It's interesting, very interesting. Not obviously much unlike what goes on at the schools, and very tragic, obviously. Yeah. And one of the crazy things, especially in a hospital or a school setting, is the fact that, you know, 99% of the time, if not even more, nothing's going on. It's that time where nobody expects it, and you know, and sometimes, you know, there's that, John, you and I have talked about all those, the gun violence in Philadelphia, and this conversation in hospitals and in schools is deadly serious. It's awesome to find out that you guys are, are putting a strategy together and have intellectualized this situation, because it's no joke. Having said that, John, this has been the fastest hour in radio.
It usually is.
But, and what's funny about it is we could go another hour.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we still got some questions left. We'll save them for the next time.
Yeah.
Raphael, fantastic broadcast.
Thank you very much. This is my first time. It's very nice.
Well, you did great. Our host, John Zervanos, a fantastic show.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
I want to thank everybody for joining us on the Saul Zervano Show here on WWDB Talk 860. We want to thank, of course, Rafael Villalobos, who is the Deputy General Counsel at Capitol Health. And, of course, we want to thank our host, John Zervanos of Saul Zervanos. On behalf of John and Rafael, I'm Joe Doherty. Thanks for listening, everybody.